Our thinking this afternoon is about cognitive development in children. And I tried to come up with a subtitle that I thought might be kind of catchy. But I think I said something like, will your three-year-old who won't share always be selfish, or something like that? And the answer is hopefully not, I guess. But I want to start the session this afternoon by asking you what color your barbecue is. What
it's
color?
Easy, we don't have one.
You don't eat barbecue?
I eat barbecue, but I don't have one. I eat it if I'm somewhere.
You eat what?
I'll eat it if I'm somewhere where they have it, but we don't own one, so.
Okay, but if you, in your part of the country where you grew up, what color is barbecue?
Are you talking about what did the product look like, or what did you do it on?
No, what did you, no, I'm talking about what does the product look like.
Okay.
Oh.
Different.
This is South Carolina. Let me start over again. When you have a sandwich or a plate that has barbecue on it, the food, what color is the barbecue?
It looks red.
Yours is red? Yours is kind of orange? Deep orange? Sarah?
It's more like black.
Okay, some people's is black, that's right. Yeah.
Brick.
Sort of brick color.
Orange.
Oranges?
Brownish red.
All of us have a schema, obviously not quite the same one for what barbecue means. For me, the barbecue is the thing, that the product, I guess, more than what you do. But anyway, the products, we all have a schema for what color our products are. And we talk about our schemas, we're talking about conceptions that we have in our heads for the way things are in the world. What is true about the world? And you see, my schema for barbecue is very different than yours, because my barbecue is not red or black or orange or any of those colors, but it's yellow. Because where I grew up, and in the part of the state I even live in now, we have mustard-based barbecue instead of ketchup-based or honey-based or tomato-based barbecue, so my barbecue is yellow. I probably was a teenager before I ever knew that barbecue could be any other color than yellow, because that was the only color I had ever been exposed to. And as long as I didn't run into any other kind of barbecue, I was in what you call a mental state of equilibrium. I was very comfortable with my notion of what barbecue was. Barbecue was yellow meat, either pork or chicken, that you eat on a plate, either by itself or on a sandwich. Okay? Let me give you one more example of what I mean by our schemas for things. I grew up in South Carolina, and you just said I was talking South Carolina, that's right. But one of the vacations that my family took very often was a vacation to the Great Smoky Mountains. And those mountains, for those of you who haven't been to the South or to the East Coast, are very, very old compared to these. They're rolling and they're rounded off on the top. They are completely green all over and tree covered. And they don't have any snow on them in the summertime. And so as I grew up, and all through my college years even, my conception of mountains was the Great Smokies, these rolling green hillsides that were covered with lots of deciduous trees as well as evergreens. In 1969, my husband and I went to Europe for the summer and spent some time in the Swiss Alps. And so for the first time, I encountered mountains that were different than the ones that I knew. Now, granted, I had seen them on television, that sort of thing, but I had never experienced them before. And what I had were mountains that were not very unlike these, but jagged, much newer mountains that had snow on the peaks of them. They had a tree line, so there was rock above the trees. And those, you know, that was a completely different conception of what a mountain was, but it still fit sort of with my understanding of mountains. So that what I was able to do was to modify the schema that I already had for what a mountain was, and to assimilate this new information into my way of thinking about things. And indeed, that's how, as adults, and children too, but as adults, how we grow in terms of our conceptions of things. But I was able to assimilate that information. I was able to make some modifications. Now, there certainly are going to be instances in our lives when we are not able, or we don't have a space for something that is new. It is so new that there's no way to fit it in with the way we already conceptualize the world. And let me give you for instance, and when this happens, another kind of process has to take place. Let me share with you a story that, again, I guess reflects my upbringing. But it's a true story, one that I love to use with my students when I talk about what accommodation means, which is the other process that I want to talk about. When I was a young teenager, one of the rites of passage into being a true teenager was that you got to shave your legs and wear hose. And I remember the Easter before I was 13, my mother bought me a lavender dress that had a wide inset piece in the middle. I remember exactly what it looked like. It had lace around the neck, and I had shoes that had low heels for the first time. And now little girls wear shoes with low heels. And I had hose. This was to be a big Easter because this represented a kind of transition day for me. And I remember that I shaved my legs the night before, and it took three Band-Aids to cover up the cut that I got right up the back of my leg right here. But I wore my hose. So for me, a part of my upbringing was that any well-groomed young woman shaved her legs and wore hose. That was the way that things were. That was the order of the world. And that was my schema for things. On this same trip to Europe in 1969, one of the things that we did was to spend 8 weeks studying German at a Goethe Institute. My husband needed the German for graduate school, and I went just to do it. Most of the teachers in this institute were men, but there was one very nice-looking German Fräulein who was a teacher there, and of course all the men were twittering about this German woman. One night, all the students at the Institute were invited to come to the local Bierstube to have a beer and listen to an Oompa band. And it just so happened that our table was right next to the table where Fräulein Müller-Schiener sat down. And she was all dressed up, I can remember to this day, but she had on a German dirndl, which is the print-like dress that's like a jumper, with a white blouse and an apron over it, and she had on high heels. And she was sitting as close to me as Meredith is and had her legs crossed, and I looked down and she had long, black, curly hair on her legs. Well, in the way that my schema worked, there was no room to allow for the possibility that a well-groomed woman was going to have hairy legs. There was no way that I could assimilate, I really think at that point in my life, that I could assimilate that bit of information. And so I had to form a whole new category that said, in some cultures, there are well-groomed, attractive women who don't shave their legs. And I had to do what you call accommodation. That was a whole nother way of thinking about the world. And just, you know, an interesting kind of sideline is that several years later, we had a good friend who was a native German, and he lived in this country for quite a long time. But I was telling Lilo about my experiences and how taken aback I was by that encounter. And she said that in Germany, women took great pride in having long black hair on their legs, and it was considered to be very sexy. So I learned something new even in my life. These notions about assimilation and accommodation come from the thought and work of Piaget, Piaget was a Swiss psychologist who spent many, many years observing children and putting together a set of, or an understanding about, the way that children develop cognitively. And when we talk about cognitive development, we are talking about the way that children come to know things. How is it that we interact with the world? When we look about our, let me back up for a minute. I want to go through these both from the standpoint of parents and thinking about schooling today. And as we do talk about the different stages, which I've outlined on the board already, I want you to think about what these stages have to say about what you teach children and what you can teach children, and what kind of implications they might well have for schooling, for the way that children are taught in school. Basically, Piaget says that children, that all children, all of us, pass through hierarchical stages of development in terms of cognitive development. These stages extend from birth to adulthood, and in many cases they overlap. There are not clear distinctive lines between them. One kind of shades into another. During times of transition between two, around the age of 2 years, children very likely will have characteristics of both the sensory motor stage and the pre-operational stage. But at each of these stages, children are going to have different ways of relating to the world around them. Let's take these one at a time and talk about what the characteristics are and what the developmental tasks are for children at those different stages. The first of the stages is the sensory motor stage. This stage lasts from birth until 2 years of age. And if you think about the name of the stage, you have a major clue for what it means to operate in that framework. During this stage, a child is in touch with his world in two ways, basically. He or she is in touch with the world, first of all, through their senses. Very, very young infants will turn their heads in response to a sound. They will stare at mobiles that are hung over their crib, all of which provide stimulation for the child. They learn through their sense of taste and their sense of smell and their sense of hearing. One of our children particularly was very in tune with the world through taste. And I spent a lot of time monitoring what went into his mouth. Rocks, plugs, paper, jar lids, pencils, whatever. He learned by putting it into his mouth. In terms of the motor part of this, children are also learning by exploring their environment. We know through research that physical movement stimulates the development of certain parts of the brain, that it is necessary and essential to the development of certain parts of the brain. And I suspect that that's why it's much less stylish today to put a child in a playpen than it was when I was growing up. I'm certain I'm probably a handicap because my mother kept me in a playpen until I must have been 3 years old so I wouldn't get hurt. But children really, really need to explore their environment. So that this is the way that they are in touch with the world, mainly through their senses and mainly through their physical exploration of their environment. For children who are in this stage, there are two major developmental tasks that need to be accomplished if the child is successfully to move on into the next stage. The first of these is the whole notion of object permanence, and the second of these is mental representation. When we talk about object permanence, we are talking about a child's understanding that an object still exists when he can no longer or she can no longer see it. It is true for a young infant that when an object is out of sight, they can no longer consider it. We know that when you talk about separation anxiety or that very traumatic experience of having to leave an infant and the infant cries and screams for its primary caretaker, that the height of separation anxiety seems to be about 10 months of age, which fits so logically with what Piaget is saying about object permanence, because by that time the infant is beginning to have a mental understanding or a mental representation for the caretaker, all of a sudden is separated from this caretaker and can't yet understand. It has no object permanence, so as yet does not understand that even though he can't see the caretaker still continues to exist. That can be such a frustrating time for parents who have to leave children in nurseries or in the nursery when children are, you know, when the infant has still not achieved this notion of object permanence. Another thing that's happening during the sensory motor stage is that the child is developing mental representation, or in essence, a memory. The child is developing schemas for the way things are, just like we as adults develop our schemas for things. They begin to have a conceptualization for juice or for a blanket, whatever the name. There's some wonderful blankets around here. If you've noticed some of the infants dragging their blankets around, I love them. One of our children, the younger one, called his meh, and he absolutely sucked the corner of his blanket rather than his thumb. And that was his name. Where he got the word, I have no idea. But children begin to have schema for the way things are, for individuals in their lives, significant individuals, as well as for the objects around them. And that is, in essence, a transition stage into the age of symbolic thought, which occurs during the next stage when language is occurring. So that by the time a child has moved through this stage, those are the major things that they should have been able to accomplish. They should have developed object permanence, so they understand that when something is not present, it still exists. And they should have developed mental representation or begun to develop mental representation for many things. Are there questions you'd like to ask or comment, Sarah?
If a child has a parent that dies, for example, during the time when it's just trying to go through that and figure that all out, mm-hmm. is that understanding then delayed, that an object is still there? I mean, did it take longer for that child to figure that out because it wasn't true in that strong case?
That may well be. Nobody has ever asked that particularly. I mean, what I do know is that what is most important for a child at this young age is that there be a primary caretaker. And it doesn't matter who it is, actually. It can be either parent or it can be a grandparent or an aunt or whatever who takes responsibility for the child. But I should think that might delay it. That's a good question. You know, if they were just beginning to get hold of who Daddy was and then something happened to Daddy, would that interfere at that young age?
Does it matter for the child if that primary caretaking is done between two people?
No, I don't think so. And that's an interesting question, because you're planning to do a lot of sharing in terms of taking care of your child. And we certainly did a lot too, and I think our kids are okay. But you know, it's very important that there be at least one stable figure in the person's life, if not others. And you know, it's very important that, especially single parents, sometimes understand it doesn't have to be the parent. I mean, it can be someone else who provides that stability for the child at that young age. Okay. Other questions? These are little people still, birth to 2 years old.
I see a lot through my experience with my own children of that happening. You know, I don't see it going into the 2 year stage, that that's a first year.
It has already happened for a lot of children. A lot of it has to do with when children develop language.
Because one thing we know is that these designations are very fuzzy. I mean, you know, you can't say today this child is this way and tomorrow they're that way. That they will carry parts of both stages with them for a while. And the transition stages vary. If you look this up in different texts, you will see different designations for the ages. They're roughly these. And these are kind of the ones I decided to use today. Mm-hmm. But in some cases, I have seen this listed as 18 months rather than 2. The next stage that the child will be moving into is what is called the pre-operational stage. And one of the major tasks during this stage is that the child is going to develop symbolic thinking, which is language. The child is going during this stage to give labels, to begin to give labels for all of those things that during this stage they were forming mental images for. And many children, of course, begin with words long before they are 2 years old, and some children have sentences by this time. So it's really fuzzy in terms of the ages, but the progression is the same. The progression is the same. But the development of language is one of the major tasks for the child during this stage. We know that by the time children are entering school, that they already have at their disposal all of the syntactic structures of our language, that they can use them all. They might not use passive voice, because they probably have never heard it used. But basically, they do complex and compound sentences, compound and complex sentences by the time they begin school. All this happens during this stage. This is a stage when socialization is very important, and it relates to some other characteristics of the stage. But certainly one way that children develop language is through their interaction with other children. So that becomes very important. It's very consistent with our emphasis on play groups and daycares and nursery care, you know, for good nursery care for children, where they are able to interact with other children.
Can I just ask, how are people doing with the music in the background? Because I would be wanting to go out and ask them to stop. Is it okay? Are people...
It doesn't bother me. Is it okay with
someone? All right.
We could... Okay. One of the primary characteristics of children at this age, and the one that gave birth to my little subtitle this afternoon, is that children who are between these ages, in these preschool years, can only see things from one point of view. And that point of view is theirs. Okay? So that these children are very, very egocentric. And sharing is very low on their list of fun things to do. Because the only thing they can think of at the time is how I feel about this toy or this object that is mine. But it even goes beyond sharing. Three-year-olds are very likely to think that the sun came up today so I could play outside. Or the tree grew in my yard so I could play in it. They are just that egocentric about the way things are. we know that children at this age have a very limited ability to empathize with other children. And it is at this point that some research is saying Piaget wasn't completely accurate, because some studies are showing that especially children at the upper end of this age range are developing empathetic abilities. But especially the younger ones in this age range are really not able to empathize. So what that means is that when you say to your child, think how Sean feels when you won't let him play with your Legos, you really are not saying anything very helpful, because the child can't do that yet. This relates to, a part of a child. The child at this age, does what you call centrate, which again means that the child not only sees things from one point of view, but the child is only able to consider one aspect of a thing at a time. And an example of a child doing that might be, perhaps you've had the experience of seeing a young child call a kitty cat a doggy, and then the child would see a picture of a horse and he would call it a doggy, and a picture of a cow and he would call it a doggy. So that what the child is looking at is the fact that these creatures all have four legs. That's what they have in common. And anything that moves around and has four legs is a doggy. Their schema is very limited at that point, and it's only when, you know, through stories being read to them and experiences with these animals, that they begin to make distinctions among them, and their schema begins to assimilate this new information, so they're able to expand that way of thinking about things. Questions?
I guess I have a
question. All right.
Is there any way of dealing with this, or how can parents keep sane until...
That's a good question. I was afraid somebody would ask that, because I sure don't have an answer.
That was the title that brought me here.
I guess the hopeful thing is that children outgrow the egocentrism. That's a characteristic, a very strong characteristic of this stage. And that as they move toward the end of that stage, they indeed do begin to grow out of that. It's very important during these years that they have the opportunity to interact with other children. And, you know, through those experiences, that's probably the very best way. I mean, you can't teach them by lecturing to them. They have to learn through the experience of being with other children and wanting to share another child's toy to begin to move out of some of that.
That interesting. That's the second time you've mentioned a quality daycare, quality nursery. My older children are 11, and they have no preschool experiences. My 2-year-old and 4-year-old as well. And I'm considering preschool or some type of cooperative preschool in our little community.
Mm-hmm.
For a 4-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But I have some real mixed feelings about it, because we're quite happy at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not a problem at all. And, you know, they fight and bicker like your two do the same way. I mean, there's a similar age gap there. And but you seem to stress that need for the interaction. Now, I didn't find it any problem for my boys to go to kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
With no preschool experience.
Had they played with other children, though, in the
neighborhood? Not an awful lot. No, other than Sunday school.
Mm-hmm. But that did give them some.
It was some, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all. But I hear you saying the importance of that over and over. And
yeah.
Sort of, I'm wondering, you know...
Well, I guess I believe that personally, but Piaget really emphasizes that the socialization is very important at that age. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, a 5-day-a-week program or anything like that, but just that they have the opportunity to interact with other children. You must have twins, do you, that are 11? So at least they had each other, so they were interacting with each other during these years. One thing that the preschool does, and this relates a little bit back to the sensory motor stage too, I guess, but it does help in some cases, I think, for children not to be so traumatized by going away from home for the first time. Mm-hmm. And you see these children who start kindergarten and scream and cry and hold on to their mother. And very often those are the children who have never been away in a play group or played with neighbor children very much or been in some kind of a more formal daycare program. And a lot of it depends on the child itself, whether or not you think that would be a good experience for the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm
still
feelings about that. Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, my boys waved goodbye.
Uh-huh.
And I dropped them off at kindergarten time. So, I mean, I don't know. I have some mixed feelings about the preschool thing. You know, pushing them away too quickly, I guess, is,
right.
I think, you know, the negative side, too.
Sure. Children are different. You know, one of ours, our older one, grew up more quickly than the younger one. And even to this day, you know, by the time our older one was the age of this child, he was more independent than this child. Of course, that's more typical of an older child, too. But even as a young child, I think he was much more independent than the young one. And so some of it has to do with that when you have choices. I mean, you have the luxury of having a choice, and a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the reason today for the emphasis on, you know, on good nursery school situations for youngsters. Jack?
If you have any suggestions, you said that the 2 to 7 period is obviously very important for language formation. We both speak Spanish as well as English, and would like, if possible, to introduce that at the appropriate time. We've had experiences of seeing children, I think their formation takes place probably better at that age, but do you have any suggestions on how we would find out about doing that in a way that isn't too confusing for a child? Are there guidelines for...
Well, you know, it would be to the child's advantage, I'll just say it that way right off the top. From experience, this is one couple in Franklin, where we used to live in Indiana, whose mother was Japanese and the father was Chinese, and they spoke English. And they didn't speak each other's languages, native languages, very well. So Tony grew up, Tony is Mark's age, and he heard all three on occasion. And when he first learned to speak, when the boys were playing together, when they were two-ish, it was the most interesting gamish of the three languages put together that you ever heard. And so for a while, it was almost like he was a little behind in terms of other people being able to understand him very well, his parents did. But by the time he was 5 or 6 years old, he knew all three of them. But it took longer to sort it out. Meredith, you've had some experience with children who speak Korean.
A little bit, I mean, I'm not an expert, but a little bit I've read is that that's usually the case is, for example, if you would probably have to be the ones, you know, be speaking Spanish
just at home
pretty consistently, and your child probably or possibly when he started kindergarten or something would not be the most verbal kid in the class in English, but within a year or so would be wherever he would normally have been. Two of our children spoke another language before they came into our family. One had just learned English. I mean, one had just learned Korean. And then he was 3 when we got him. And I think what he did was he got stubborn and said, I just spent all this time learning one language. I'm not going to learn another one. because we'd had an older child who'd come at age 9 and who had learned it just very, very quickly. And then usually they say the younger the child, the easier they learn. But our son, I'm sure that was what he decided was, you know, he wasn't going
to take the trouble to do it.
But within a year, and now he's been with us 3 years, and his language is where I think a child his age would be. But he still has
like double negatives in Korean are different, or you know, the negative concept is different than in English. And he still, even though he knows no Korean anymore, he still gets pretty confused.
I wondered if, if there were any way you could maintain that for him.
Well, not unless he's so far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably the best way to teach it is just to use it at home. Mm-hmm. And never make a point of it, yeah, but just to use it at home. And then the child will pick up a lot of it.
We were raised by children by the Our older one, her own journey until he was 2 years old. And to him, learning the names, that was just the names. It wasn't anything, well, this is English and this is German. He just saw it and he knew the name for it. He learned German just as easily as he learned English. He actually had to learn English for his grandparents because we never spoke English to him. But I did find when he reached an age where he figured out he was the only one who heard the German. Everybody else heard English. He moved out to his field and he was not going to tolerate hearing that in language anymore. So we backed off and I'm sad to say it disappeared rather quickly, and he's four now and we're just starting to build it up with him. But he picks it up like he was
pulling. Oh, so quickly.
There's hope.
Yeah. Okay.
So it can be done.
Yeah. Well, see, we have an interesting, a similar experience with a niece of mine who's, my sister doesn't know another language, but the babysitter that's with the kids full time speaks to them in Spanish. And the oldest one, again, she all of a sudden put her foot down, and my sister gets so frustrated because she won't try to speak Spanish anymore. Mm-hmm. She's two, what, three?
Three.
I don't know. But
I've seen that with, I have several Korean brothers and sisters, and when they've come and they almost need to go through that, I want to be like everybody else stage, and that's when they lose all their Korean.
It's a part of their culturation. Mm-hmm. We definitely know that all of us lose our ability to acquire a second language about the time of puberty, that it diminishes, not lose it, but it diminishes dramatically about the time of puberty. And there are very few adults who have learned a second language as adults, as adolescents or adults, who speak it without any accent. It's almost impossible to do. No matter how proficient you are at the grammar, you can't deny your native tongue. But if you do it before that, it's a real curiosity about the way the mind works in the acquisition of language. If you do it before that, it's a very natural process, and I would just speak it at home as a way, because we learned, the children learn by imitation.
Just to substantiate that, my sons are in a French immersion program. We're Canadian, or I'm not, but my, of course my family is, and they started in kindergarten in French totally. Mm-hmm. There is no French spoken in British Columbia, all you Americans. Mm-hmm. But because Canada is a bilingual country, they have to offer the French program to even in an English area. So if there's enough parents that choose French, then your child can be educated in French. And at 11, they're fluent bilingual. Marvelous accents. Uh-huh. That's really,
that's so exciting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's really neat.
Why is it then that in the U.S. we don't start teaching foreign languages for high school?
It's really a mistake. Part of it is, it's a mistake, but part of it is that there's no reinforcement for it. Because we are so single-minded about what the native tongue is, until if you don't use a language, you lose it. And so if there's no reason to apply it, it wouldn't last anyway. So it would have to be a major movement nationwide for it to work. Was that the harpsichord?
Yes, it was.
Was someone there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were carrying it down the stairs. And they took it over.
They were carrying it themselves. Wasn't someone else carrying it?
Well, we need to take a moment for the harpsichord. We were so struck by that very thing you're saying, in a sense, by being in Canada for a while, and at least people are aware of other languages, and here that's not even true. And especially if you live in parts of the country that aren't heavily populated with Hispanic people. I think California and Texas and Florida, you would get more reinforcement for being bilingual in Spanish and English than you sure would get in South Carolina.
In Chicago, it's some ways of three languages.
Well, probably so. All right, let me go be sure I get through these. This third stage is the stage of concrete operations and represents the kind of thinking that is going to occur when children are in school. These are the elementary years. The major transition point between these pre-operational children and these children who are at the stage of concrete operations is that they have acquired the ability to conserve, or they have achieved conservation. What you mean by conservation is that children understand that even though the shape or form of something may change, the quantity of it remains the same. It has to do with their outgrowing that tendency to centrate, that tendency to see only one aspect of a thing at a time. Because in order to think logically about things, in order to do word problems in math, children have to be able to consider several things at one time. If you do area, you have to consider length and width. If you do double-digit addition, or whatever you call it when you've got two figures, you have to be able to think of both columns, the ones and the tens. A major transition then comes in children's ability to conserve. And one of the most fascinating things we could do was to have five-year-olds come in. I knew our time was too short to do this afternoon. Maybe a five-year-old and a seven-year-old come in and give them some of Piaget's developmental tasks to make the point that there is a dramatic difference in children who are still in this stage and children who are moving into this stage. There are a whole series of tasks that Piaget has, but one that I just brought to demonstrate, and this is kind of hard to see. This is conservation of volume, but if you have two glasses like this with water in them, I don't know if you can see the water level because the glasses are amber, but you have the child fix it so that there is exactly the same amount of water in both glasses. Okay, and you ask a pre-operational child, a five-year-old, four-year-old child, first of all, you would say, do the glasses have the same amount of water in them? And if they don't, you have the child fix it so they do. Okay. And the child would get to the point where he would agree with you, yes, they have the same amount of water in them. And then with that very same child watching, you take the water in this glass and you pour it in this one. And the water level, I didn't have quite enough water, but the water level will rise higher in this one. Okay. And you say to the child, do the glasses have the same amount of water in them? And the child will be absolutely sure that this one has the most water in it. I mean, absolutely dogmatically sure, because the water level of the glass will be higher. There are a whole series of tasks. Another one that I do with children sometimes is that I take 10 Tinker Toys, the little round ones, and I put them in a row. And then I take 10 more and I put them in a row right above it. And you make them so they touch each other in the rows. And then you have the child count them. And you say to the child, are there the same number of Tinker Toys in each row? And many of these children by 5 years old can count one, two, all the way to 10. And they will say yes. And then in their presence, with them watching, you take one of the rows of Tinker Toys and you spread them out. And you say to the child, are there the same number of Tinker Toys in the two rows? And they are absolutely positive that the longer row has more Tinker Toys in it. Okay. They cannot consider two things at once. They can't consider the number and the length of the row. And what happens is that children will gradually figure that out. If you ask the same child a year later the same question, they will be absolutely sure that the longer row and the shorter row have the same number of Tinker Toys in it, because I just counted them. It's very interesting to watch children and to see how convinced they are that they are correct. And in their way of thinking at that time, they certainly are. But during the elementary years, notice that this is called the stage of concrete operations. children learn concretely. And I think that's a point where we run into problems in schooling a lot of times. But it is very important that things that are presented to children in classrooms, as well as things, learning experiences that are provided for children at home, be hands-on kinds of experiences. With science, you're going to do field trips. With social studies, projects are going to work best. And certainly with math, math should be taught as or with manipulative, so that children are moving blocks or stacking blocks or rearranging things or cutting things into pieces. It should be very manipulative. We really work on that with student teachers in terms of getting them to present things manipulatively, because it gets so easy, especially as children get a little bit older, third, fourth, fifth grade, to quit doing that, and especially with math, to make math such a paper and pencil kind of task when children really are not able to handle that conceptually. And so children are not as successful many times, and for many, math becomes a real hang-up in school when it didn't have to be that way. It's really the teacher's fault that it's that way. Another implication that it has for schooling is whether or not it's appropriate to really teach geography in elementary school, because children lack the ability to abstract at this point. So can they really make any sense out of the fact that this map represents something else? Many children have no notion at all of what a city and a county and a state and a nation is. That makes no sense to them. That's a very abstract kind of thing. You do a lot of the perennial first grade unit is communities. What is a community? And all this. But you know, teachers need to be so aware, and parents too, that there are limits on children's ability to think abstractly at this point. Another real controversial thing is whether or not it's appropriate to teach algebra in middle school. Because you do have some children who manage to get through it by memorizing a lot, but they really don't understand it. And so when they move on into higher math, into second year algebra or higher levels of math, they run into all kinds of problems because they learned algebra too early. And there's a lot of controversy about the appropriate age. And parents take such pride in the fact that my child started algebra in the sixth grade or the seventh grade or whenever. And that may very well be the wrong time for children to start algebra. Another thing that happens during this stage is that children improve significantly in their ability to classify and categorize objects. If you ask a child in the pre-operational stage to categorize, let's say, blocks of assorted sizes and colors, they will do it one way, and that's the only way that they can do it, okay, because they can only see things from one point of view. But as children move into this part of their lives, they are increasingly able to make many different kinds of arrangements out of the same blocks, to categorize and classify them. An activity that I do, I teach reading when I reading methods, and I have my students, as an introduction to main idea, do a lots of different categorizing and classifying activities. I give them bags of buttons, and they have to come up with as many different ways as they can to categorize the buttons. Because we know that for a child to be able to understand main idea, a child has to be able to categorize and classify things. That's the prerequisite skill for the understanding of main idea. And you think about how you get to a main idea. That's the basic question for the learning of science and social studies and history and literature and whatever. How do you get the main idea of the text? And you do it by sorting out what is important and putting it into groups and coming up with the main idea. So it's a very important developmental task during these years, and one that children really need to be given experience and practice in all different areas of schooling, in all different content areas where they are categorizing and classifying things. Questions about school years, about elementary school years? Yes.
Do you have a math program that you suggest on school teachers?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of math curriculum
I don't know a curriculum. I'm not really a math person, but I know that, you know, that our math person on our staff just over-teaches the use of manipulatives, hoping that about a third of it will stick so that teachers will really use a lot of manipulatives. And even with older children, it's such a logical way to start with young children, first grade. But what happens is that so quickly wears off, and math is strictly the problems on page 29 rather than, you know, a chance to understand the concept manipulatively before you use that for practice and review, before you use the paper and pencil for practice and review. I wish I could be helpful in that. Other questions about school years, the elementary school year?
Just a comment that I see in my two kids, that my boy just coming out of pre-operation, my daughter's already in concrete.
Right.
And a lot of the problems that they have amongst each other is that my daughter, she's trying to explain to my little boy something, he just, he can't quite get it, he gets frustrated, she gets frustrated, and they're battling half the time, trying to explain things to each other.
And they're looking at it in a different way.
Yeah.
Let me wind up. We've got just a few minutes, and I want to touch on this one. This is the stage of formal operations, and it's the stage where most of us are now in regards to some things. but this is the stage at which we do acquire the ability to think abstractly, and it's the stage when it is appropriate to teach algebra to children. It's also, it's the stage at which children are able to entertain the notion that there's more than one possible answer to a question. It's when we can begin to have any little hint of what, or understanding of what ambiguity might mean. Children are able to deal with hypothetical situations at that point when they can think abstractly. Suppose, or what if, and you can give these wonderful projects where they have to pretend that they are, and then they can apply what they know in a hypothetical kind of situation. It's the kind of thought that allows us to really enjoy and deal with subjects like religion or like economics, all of the social sciences, where you're looking at things from different points of view, become much more meaningful and interesting once children reach the stage of formal operations. And this line is probably the fuzziest one of all. I picked 12, some people pick 11, but it, anywhere from about 11 to about 15, which is a lot of difference, because that's somewhere between 6th grade and about 10th grade, children are going to move into this stage of formal operations where they are able to think abstractly. That's what makes teaching middle school so tough, because you don't know where children are. And the same thing is true if you are a first grade teacher, because you don't know where children are, kindergarten or first grade teacher. But middle school is even, I think, more scattered than first grade and kindergarten. People who teach middle school need a little extra salute. Adults operate in the stage of formal operations, and I'll just sort of pull this together by saying this, and all of us operate abstractly about things that we know well. Now, if I talk to you about reading or about education, I'm comfortable with that, and I can think about what ifs. I can deal with that abstractly. But when we go home, our computer's boxed up because we just moved. If I had to set it up again, to hook the printer and the monitor to the computer and all, I would have to get out the manual, and I would do it step by step by step by step. I would need the concrete. And that's true for all of us as adults. We operate on both levels all the time. Things that we don't know well are concrete. We operate concretely out, in relation to them. Things that we are familiar with, we are able to deal with abstractly. Are there things or last-minute things you would like to comment upon, or questions you would like to ask?
This is these transitions that you speak of. I see the sons going into the formal level. They're just turning 11, but yet I can see that they're able to conceptualize different things that they weren't able to a year ago.
Absolutely.
But is there a means of enabling children to go through these stages, or does it have to happen within them? Is it a maturing within them that you can't either hasten or slow down?
I'm glad that you asked that. And
Piaget would say that basically children have to move through these in their own good time. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that we do children a disservice when we push them too hard. And, you know, the algebra is a good example. When you try to teach something that abstract to a child who is not ready for that. Mm-hmm. But that we can encourage them by giving them the right kinds of experiences at the right time. Mm-hmm. The interaction with friends here, the learning through concrete objects here as a way of enabling them to make that transition. So we can make it smoother, but there are limits to the degree to which we can push them.